So I am very grateful to be part of this panel, grateful to Lisa and the planning committee who put this together, and always grateful to Nancy Krieger, because for some of us, these pedagogy sessions go back decades, and they're always a highlight of APHA. So my work in engaging students and elders in social justice research and action is grounded in the critical pedagogy of Paulo Freire. Many of you know Freire, and the emphasis on praxis and on creating spaces where people can share their wisdom and look at common issues, look at root causes, and come up with action plans. But it's also grounded in social action organizing, folks like Cesar Chavez, Martin Luther King Jr., Saul Alinsky, and Maggie Kuhn, the founder of the Gray Panthers. And finally, there's a lesser-known area, except to Marty Martinson, called critical gerontology, which really looks at how political and economic factors come together, how the intersections of race, ethnicity, class, gender, sexual orientation, ability, disability, all these things interact to help shape and determine the experience of growing old and the centrality and of power and privilege in these processes. And finally, critical gerontology accents social change. You don't just study aging, you do something for and with elders. So I'm going to describe three projects, and I'm later going to ask students involved in them to raise their hands because there are quite a few here. But these occurred over the span of my career teaching, which is now 38 years. And I want to start going back to 1978 to something called TESOP. This was the idea of three of my students, graduate students in the School of Public Health, got the idea of starting informal discussion groups in Tenderloin hotels as a way of breaking down social isolation and promoting change. My dear friend and a colleague we lost much too early, Cheryl Franz, was the first one to come up with this and wanted to use a Freirean approach to try to create informal discussion groups and get folks to really use the Freire method in their work. And I'm already not reading, so okay. Anyway, she started out with two students in the role of teacher learners in a single hotel. They facilitated a weekly discussion group. They had residents come up with issues they cared about. And we tried to use the Freire method of coming up with codifications or pictures that capture what your concerns are. We did have some initial success. For example, one of the residents ran up to his room when we were talking about the two-tier medical care system, the lousy access to care for people in this neighborhood, and he brought down an unlabeled bottle of medicine. He said, "I got this from a crowded community clinic down the street." And why is this happening? Why do we get the unlabeled bottle of medicine? The project, as I said, it worked a little bit with the Freirean method. But then Robin Wexler, who was the real program architect, came in and she and some of the other early students said, you know, this doesn't work well here unless we back up. We've got to start by breaking down the huge distrust that's here, reducing the social isolation, helping elders to identify with each other as a community and address shared concerns. We can't do that discussion, and certainly not critical analysis, until we break down the isolation. And I always say the four most important words in organizing: refreshments will be served. So the students would come every week with muffins and coffee, and then the nutrition students joined, and we had to up the ante and make it healthy refreshments. But anyway, that was critical. The main thing, though, that the students brought was an openness to hearing the concerns of residents and helping them then discuss and collectively identify them. Not surprisingly, in this neighborhood, which is only a few blocks from here, the number one issue across the first six hotel groups was crime in this neighborhood, whose crime rate was two crimes per person per year, mostly violent crime. Well, the residents convened a community-wide meeting. They got 150 people there on the subject of crime. They demanded and got a meeting with Mayor Feinstein at the time. And she not only went to see her, but they said, "You've got to come to the Tenderloin. You've got to meet with our hotel groups, because most of our folks can't even get down to your office. She came to 5 of the 6 groups with 16 cops for her protection. Tells you something. But the residents also, they did get concessions from her, but they also started this inner hotel coalition, Tenderloin Centers for Safer Streets, to get stores and other venues to be places of refuge where they could go if they were being followed or had been attacked. And, you know, it was a good idea. I mean, it was resident-driven. They got 48 safe houses in the first year. The crime rate went down 18%. Well, they got all this credit for it. We knew it was because of the rainfall. But that's okay. They felt really, I mean, they certainly deserve some of the credit. But, you know, the fact is they felt empowered. They really felt, we have made a change. And they went on to another issue, food insecurity. They started resident-run mini-markets in 4 of the hotels. This was long before you had the vendors with the wonderful fresh fruits and vegetables outside. Nothing in this neighborhood. They started a food bank in one of the hotels. And they started they developed this no-cook cookbook, the only cookbook you'll ever see with hand-drawn rats and roaches on the first pages. I wanted to make a comment, though. In each of these cases, we tried to talk with them critically as well. So the Safe House Project, we supported them, but then the students also talked to them about, you know, we really can't villainize the people who are the perpetrators of crime in this neighborhood because they're victims of deplorable circumstances. So in one hotel, one of the worst ones we were working in, the older residents, mostly white men, did a resume writing workshop for the young men who were mostly African American and with whom there had been some friction. And in those days, you could get jobs if you had a resume. So it was a helpful thing to do. But it was trying to, again, bridge alliances across differences of race and class and everything else. Not class, I meant age. Okay, finally, Jack Geiger came to visit Peace Up, one of my happiest days of my life, and the residents were so impressed with him, they started a Tenderloin chapter of the Nuclear Freeze. But the most important thing, I think, is that as the residents became increasingly committed to changing the conditions where they lived, they created 14 tenant organizations. And they did things like get $10,000 from the rent board for being in a building that had an out-of-service elevator for 6 months. They got upgraded plumbing and lead abatement. They got a vending machine with healthy food in a building. This was long before we were doing these vending machine changeovers. And I think most impressive, they took on Hastings Law School, a prominent local law school that had reneged on promises of security. So they took them on 4 of the buildings, and they got an out-of-court settlement. So this project went on for 16 years, became a nonprofit. There were more than 300 students involved, at least one of whom is here, Buffy Bunting. Big shout out to Buffy, to the 300 teacher learners who stayed with this project for years, and the director, Cheryl France, Robin Wexler, Diana Miller, and Lydia Ferrante. Okay, let me quickly turn to a second project, the Grandparent Caregiver Study, which is one that my dear friend Kathleen Rowe and I undertook with African-American students at Berkeley. Oops, I'll come back to my picture of Lisa. Anyway, students from both San Jose State and UC Berkeley, and with African-American, our students there, and with grandparent caregivers themselves, who were doing this role because of the crack cocaine epidemic. As many of you know, the number of kids being raised by grandparents grew dramatically when the crack cocaine epidemic took off in the 80s, continued to grow, and one of the main reasons was the disparate sentencing, the fact that if you're smoking crack, you get a way higher sentence, conveniently you happen to be black, than if you're using powder at some party in a rich part of wherever you live. And I'll just put in a political message. Joe Biden was the guy who finally got rid of this in 2007. Okay, well, the high incarceration rates of women during this period were one of the contributors to grandparent caregiving, because the women who were jailed Three-quarters of them had kids. Two-thirds of those kids went to grandparents. So we had all these reasons that grandparents were suffering the personal tragedies that they were, seeing grandchildren abused and neglected, taking them in. But they were also suffering public tragedies. The fact that at that time, if you took in your own grandkids, you got about a third of what you would get if you took in somebody else's, if you were a foster care parent. It was absolutely ridiculous and awful. Well, Kathy Rowe and I both knew women in this situation. We really wanted to do something about this. But, you know, question whether two white women, Blondie here, should have anything to do with an issue like this in Oakland was really open to question. So we talked to a number of our African-American colleagues, and we read this great book, Black Feminist Thought, in which Patricia Hill Collins says that black women's experience needs to be valued and acknowledged, but you shouldn't use it, white women. You shouldn't use skin color as an excuse for ignoring the experiences of people of color in your scholarship. That helped. So we felt maybe we have a role in this to play. And we started by going to two African-American community-based organizations with Frankie Saunders, who some of you may remember, wonderful African-American woman with deep roots in Oakland. And we just said, you know, this looks to us to be a really important issue. Is it? Does it matter to you? Does it matter to your community? Is it something we as outsiders might have a role in helping you study and address? If so, would you partner with us, and what would we have to do to make it worth your while? So we didn't write a grant for this study until those two organizations said, thank God, somebody's bringing this up. We got to do something about this. Yes, we want in. And then we wrote a small grant with a lot of the money going to them. Well, those community-based organizations were phenomenal. There's Lisa right off Google. Anyway, we recruited these six African-American students who were terrific, and Lisa was one of our favorites. And I'll talk about their role in a minute. We also recruited African-American older women to be on a community advisory board, and they were terrific as well. The CAB, for example, helped recruit 130 women to be part of this study. They helped refine the research questions, the study instrument. I said, I don't think we should even ask about women because so many, or about income because so many people are having to go through the informal economy. And they said, oh, sure, just ask how much money is available for helping you raise your child. Different phrasing, got wonderful detailed responses. They also helped in the social action component of the program. And the students also, many, many roles. For example, Lisa and I would go to do an interview with the grandparent. It would last 2 to 4 hours. She'd pour her heart out, but I didn't know if my presence in the room was an impediment. So Lisa would go back a week or two later by herself for a shorter interview and then get even greater information. So it was very helpful. The students helped with data interpretation and with the action phase of the project, which in participatory research always means you start by giving back to the community, and they, community and students and some of us, plan this big celebration for the community participants and engage them in data analysis and in action planning. One of the things that became clear very early on is that these women wanted to do something. As busy as they were, they wanted to help other grandparent caregivers, and they wanted to work for policy change. So we, as we interviewed them, we also talked about a warm line that was being held out of a supervisor's office, not a suicide line. They were too busy to kill themselves, but a warm line. They started their own respite center. They did a rally on City Hall steps, 250 grandparents. We also continued this action phase for many years, creating a regional and statewide coalition on grandparent caregiving, a newsletter run by one of the grandparents in the study. And we started this big information and advocacy center at UC Berkeley. It outgrew Berkeley after a few years. We transferred it with some trepidation, I must say, to AARP. They've become a huge advocacy organization for grandparent caregivers. So that was a fun project, a heartbreaking one, but one that also led to many now much more empowered grandparents going on, doing wonderful work in their communities, and two of whom became involved in the last project that I will mention, the California Senior Leaders Program, which is going on from 2002 to this day. And I want to begin with a huge shout out to Marty Martinson, Lisa Romero, I couldn't find a decent picture on Google, Julia Kaplan, and Ana Lilia Garcia, our four project directors over the last decade. This would not be what it became or was without all of them. Well, cut the clock for 5 minutes. Okay, that's all I really need here. I'm going to really wind up with this project. Okay, so over the last 10 years, the Wellness Foundation has funded this School of Public Health-led effort to identify and provide additional training and support to over 150 seniors, go up in age to 102, and they were or are making incredible contributions on multiple levels to healthy aging, to community building, and to social justice. Now, unlike the membership of most aging organizations, OWL, Older Women's League, Grey Panthers, AARP, these are not mostly white middle-class folks. They are mostly from communities of color. They're LGBT elders, they're rural elders, inner city folks, and they include amazing people. Two of the Japanese American elders were concentration camps, the internment camps, for 2 years growing up. They have spent their retirement keeping the memory alive, educating young people about this dark period in our history, and fighting discrimination against other groups, most particularly and recently Arabs. They include a number of Native American elders who are working on different issues involving their community, and in particular fighting things like big tobacco's co-optation of Native symbols and traditions. A lot of LGBT seniors who work on marriage equity, equality, open housing for LGBT seniors, and visibility. And then finally, people in rural areas working on things like improved access to transportation, particularly out in rural areas. Well, the folks that we identified through a statewide nomination process, 30 of them are picked to participate in a two-day honoring and training event. It takes place every other year, and they're paired with graduate students who volunteer by interest area. So you have a group of seniors interested in changing policy, 3 minutes, and they'll work with two students who will remain engaged with them over the next 15 months, individually, coming to summer reunions, coming to advocacy days in Sacramento and so forth. I don't know if Davina's here. I took off my glasses. Davina, great. Anyway, they're unbelievable students. They've also helped in recent years developing personalized press releases on each of the seniors so they get recognition locally. Marty Martinson was the main one to work on a senior networker newsletter, which was wonderful. We have a participatory video led by another student, and a website that I encourage you to go through, calseniorleaders.org, and then a 90-page booklet for each cohort that tells the story in pictures and words of their 30 or so folks. Well, the students also played a key role as the seniors decided to form their own cross-class advocacy organization, the California Senior Leaders Alliance, which since 2008 has been going to Sacramento for advocacy and education days. They've worked on measures like the Elder Economic Security Index, which recently passed, expanding access to CalFresh, and so forth. And because of the diversity of this group and the tremendous grassroots activism, they have been credited by legislators, increasingly called upon to help with progressive legislation, and they've been credited in Sacramento with being a force to contend with. So I'm out of time. I want to just close, skipping through these last pictures, with three quotes. The first one from one of the student volunteers who said, "Student leaders see something that so many of my younger peers seem to miss. They understand that each of us holds immense potential to affect change." He felt much more encouraged about what he could do in the world after working with these seniors. Second one comes from Maggie Kuhn, who said, "We're a new breed of old people, testers, builders, watchdogs, advocates, monitors, and critical advocates." Well, the elders with whom my students and I have been privileged to work certainly live up to this characterization. And finally, let me leave you with a quote of one of our senior leaders, a giant of a man who we lost last year, Mr. Frank Rose. And when asked at the first training about what was his superpower, he said, "I don't think outside the box. I think outside the warehouse." It's become our motto. It's on all our T-shirts. And I really think working with elders and students to promote social justice does require that we think outside the warehouse. And that means thinking not only about issues at hand, but about the broader socioeconomic issues and their intersections and impacts. With the browning of the graying of America and everything else going on, we can do nothing less. And I am so grateful to the students and the elders involved in this project for teaching me, as no book ever could, about critical gerontology and about the power and wisdom of elders and their younger allies in the fight for social justice. So thank you. And could I just ask the people who have been involved in any of these projects to raise their hands? And I'll put my glasses on so I can see it. All right. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Are there any, should I ask any questions, or are we out of time?
I was going to ask all the speakers to come up in case. Would all you speakers who think outside the warehouse please come up here so that if there's any questions, you can field them with a microphone? You too. Of course. We have just over 15 minutes, close to 20 minutes for questions, comments, whatever. And I'm looking forward to it. Is that directed to Mary or anybody in particular? Okay, and then anybody or whatever.
Okay. Yeah, I think we make a mistake when we separate the personal and the political. These folks who get sick are still part of our political family, and Frank Rose and others had, you know, constant contact from the other senior leaders and from us. I mean, we wanted to let them know right till the very end we're there for them, and a number of us turned out for the funeral and have done that for others. But I think that message is important. And when I will say, when I first joined the Tenderloin and we had these meetings in the hotel lobbies, you'd walk into the lobby and there'd be a huge pile of clothes and they'd say, "Oh, Joe died." That's how the residents would find out, the clothes thrown in the lobby for people to take. And one of the first things we did was make sure we had memorials for any member who died so that there was some closure for people, to use the word I hate.
Would anybody else like to say something about that? Not that I'm one of the experts on this panel, but I mean, one of the things that struck me when you were talking is that it seems like the basis of everything that all the speakers are talking about is how we build community and how actually the activism grows out of the community. So just to, and, you know, Dr. King used to talk about the beloved community. So I think we're hard-pressed to separate that personal and political, right? Even though often it raises challenges that wouldn't be there if we were pretending the reality of our lives weren't there. So I thank you for your question. Are there any other questions or comments? We do have time. Thank you. Yes. Thank you. One, two, three. Okay. They'll work it out. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
Hello again. Some of the ways we showed the video, well, we actually had a premiere. Yeah, we had a premiere at the spot, actually, at the youth center, and there was a full house, and we were just able to show it to a lot of fellow programs in the community, especially in Chinatown and other parts of Oakland. And also, we distribute the video by, like, you know, social networks, like Facebook, and then we uploaded them on YouTube, and a majority of us showed it to our families and peers personally, because even though the video was shown in public, it was also kind of like a personal growth for each individual, so we showed it to a lot of our friends and everything. And you got anything to add? Like, yeah.
Good job, man. Thank you. So everything Jeffrey said, I think one of the things we were hoping to do was submit them to, like, local film festivals. But along the way, because I have no experience making video, producing video, editing, or even, like, the legalities around it, but we definitely tried to submit them to a lot of local film festivals. But due to, you know, legal limitations around using copyrighted music and all that stuff, we weren't able to get them accepted. So, and that being that our program ended in June, and a lot of our youngsters, you know, they have their lives to live, so they didn't really have the time and energy to come back to re-edit their videos, even just to include, you know, music, you know, by whoever, who, and such and such. So we're actually, that's one thing that we're taking as a lesson that we're learning along the way, is like, if we're going to, you know, use other folks' materials or whatever to properly cite them in the film credits. But yeah, but I think just the premiere itself was a big lesson in that, like, kind of like what Gowen said, like, us separating our personal, political, and professional lives. I think what we really tried to encourage was that for the young men, they had to do all the outreach, right? I could only do what I could with the peers that I work with, but we really wanted it to be a family affair, because so often, as young folks, they leave the house to go to school, do what they do, and they don't come back till nighttime, and parents don't really know what young folks are doing. So we wanted to give parents a reason to say, oh, so that's what you've been doing every Wednesday for the past, you know, 6 months or whatever, and the other parents are out there, and they're proud of it, and they could respect it too. So we just wanted to give some sort of, like, launching point for our young folks to, like, connect all of the different aspects of their lives. Thank you.
So how can you access
that on YouTube? Oh, okay. So, dang. So we have them all linked up on YouTube. I think maybe if we could get together, I could give you the link. But David knows all of them too.
Could do is post it at Spirit 48. Are you on our list?
Not.
Oh, you're not? Okay. Well then,
do you know the link off?
Yeah, because maybe this will be an excuse for you to join the Spirit 48. Because I was thinking what we could do is post a link on our email thing, and then you could get the link. Okay.
Yeah. There were four videos total.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. You know these folks are here.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Cool.
Go ahead.
My Thank you.
Buffy.
I don't think there have been many changes that I know about in the laws. I think what we find is that the health departments find ways to do the work differently, since it's not about programs or services. It has to do with things in the workforce. Who are they hiring? Are they hiring people from the community? Are they hiring people that have backgrounds in things other than epidemiology? Getting information and knowledge from community residents? Are they doing this with a whole different frame than simply looking at themselves as technicians, but again thinking of themselves, as I was saying, as citizen professionals who have certain kinds of obligations of working with other agencies, things that they're not asked to do, but the ways in which they organize their departments differently and ways in which they work differently with the communities, and with a notion that their work is about social change. But they still have to do that work under the statutory requirements, but they find ways to do that differently and in addition to and making real allies with community organizers as well. So I'm not sure if that answers, but...
You want to go and then Nancy? Nancy. Oh, you want to say a word? Okay. And then, yeah.
Yes, just really quickly. We've had difficulties, too, in dealing with the credentialing and how do you deal with health equity when the credentialing is about, doesn't have content to it. It's about, you know, kind of paperwork and counting things and so forth. And the essential services of public health, in thinking of them that way and trying to stuff, you know, health equity into those things, it doesn't work. We have to think of a different structure. So we're trying to find ways around that, even though people are talking to us, well, what's the health equity focus for accredited? Well, you're doing it, the whole thing has to be rethought.
Thank you. Yeah, Nancy.
People
I'll second that. One more.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for what everybody's bringing to the table today. I think for us, like it always, everything starts personally, you know, and I feel that being a student of ethnic studies, but also being raised, you know, like there's a saying that I heard growing up was that, you know, raised in the hustle, enlightened by the struggle, you know what I'm saying? And I got to be around a lot of folks that made changes in their lives that may have started off as, you know, gangbangers, that may have started off as hustlers, drug dealers, pimps, but somehow along the way, they found something else that filled a bigger void in their lives, you know, that money couldn't do, you know. So I think for me, just being a part of ethnic studies and really, we're very close to, has anybody here heard of the International Hotel that used to exist, right? So that's like a huge part, there you go, right? So like a huge part of like the origin of ethnic studies was really young folks of color really looking at the status quo and challenging it, but instead of just taking off from there, they did a lot of looking back and connecting and building with elders. So knowing that the International Hotel is just right by here kind of brings it to a different sense of perspective. So always just really, I don't know, I just feel like I'm super privileged, you feel me? Even though I grew up in Oakland, I grew up in Richmond, and I messed up out of high school for a period of time, I still was able to bounce back because someone older looked out for me. You know, one of those people that really looked out for me was Richard Aoki, who was one of the co-founding members of the Black Panther Party, who's Japanese-American that grew up in West Oakland, you know, where I lived for a long time. So just really, I don't know, I'm just really appreciative, and I really value just knowledge. And that I definitely know that trying to build these bridges of like the wisdom from the OGs to a lot of what the young folks bring to the table, like I get to witness all of that. And to me, that's just like, oh my God, you're like, oh, I'm the luckiest cat in the world. And I get to, the most I am is a facilitator, right? The most I can do is really try to like start the conversations. A lot of our activities and workshops really just involve me asking questions and trying to bring it out of the young folks and not really sit there and talk at them, because they already get that for like 6-7 hours a day. But we know that the answers really all come from everybody. And honestly, this is going to sound corny as hell from a dude that grew up on the turf, but in the end, like, everything that we do, even though a part of our work does call out all kinds of isms and white supremacy and patriarchy and homophobia, everything that I do personally, it all starts with love. You feel me? And I know it sounds hella corny, and I know it doesn't sound like this is something, you know what I'm saying? But like, that's where it all comes from, you know? So everything, right?
Yeah.
See? So, and the thing is that, like I said, and so adding all of that on top of being around really innovative organizations and programs that like really, and that made everything become intentional, right? Everything we try to do, we try to be intentional about our actions and how we deliver whatever it is we're trying to put out there for our young folks. So love, yeah, is really my answer, and really just being motivated by that rather than, you know, being motivated by hating the system or the man or whatever, or capitalism, you know what I'm saying? Like starting from the point of myself and knowing what I know and acknowledging my own privileges that I can move forward from there, and that with that in mind, I really just have come to value other people's stories. So tell them, you know, like I want to hear them, and then try to connect bridges from there. So I hope that made sense. I'm really bad at answering questions, so no. Thank you.
Are we out of time, or do we have time for one more? Did you have a Okay, please. Thank you for that. Yeah. Yes, it is. It is. I mean, I'm sure that there are a lot of examples out there of all of you who have been doing this work, and it's beautiful. So I thank you all for coming. Thank you all for being amazing, and I thank this panel again. So.